episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
Cool. Quick rundown of like, no, most things are no. Don't go see them. They're pretty bad. It's been a bad summer for movies, I think, in some ways. What hasn't been terrible, though, was Green Knight. I think we should open talking about Green Knight. And maybe a comparison of the movie 9 Days. Both very different movies, but I think these were two highlights of the summer for us.
Yeah, and I feel like both of them are good examples of what Slate House is looking for in stories and books. Like, what they did with the movies are good examples, because both are genre movies, but both don't feel like genre movies. They don't have the core staples. So, do you want to start with Green Knight?
Yeah, sure. Green Knight, directed by David Lowery, written by David Lowery. Starring David Lowery? No, he wasn't.
He's not M. Night Shyamalan.
A lot of those movies, though,
yeah,
where we've seen, like, directed by, written by, produced by.
He's not M. Night Shyamalan.
No.
Or Lisa Joy, and I think I forgot to put that
Lisa
that
Joy
reminiscences on our list. So
she
I don't
was
know.
The we accent might... coach for that movie too.
She was the choreographer for the swim scenes. She was. We did this joke already on the old episode. We can't really do it again, although it lends itself really well.
Can't we, though? Lisa Joy's pretty bad.
So right. Who starred in The Green Knight?
Dev Patel.
I want to see a movie starring Dev Patel and Dave Chappelle. I just think that would be a fun movie to see. I think that would be fun.
I'm sure they would enjoy making that
movie. It's like a buddy cop movie starring Dev Patel and Dave Chappelle. And people just have shit ton of fun saying the two names together.
I would watch it for sure. Dev Patel, he's actually been breaking out in a lot of stuff. I feel like this is one of his best performances so far. He brings just a lot of, human vulnerability to Sir Gawain, who I think traditionally has been, you know, kind of like this paragon of chivalry. So to see a more vulnerable Sir Gawain in this movie was a lot of fun. It's also got Alicia Vikander. I think that's how you say her name, maybe.
I don't know. I was going to go with Vikander, but I think between the two of us, we've got it covered. Or some people can mix and match, too. Maybe it's Vikander.
We should really maybe research this before we talk about it.
I don't know. I think that's part of the fun.
Yeah. Joel Edgerton is also in this movie. He plays a role that I thought was kind of interesting. This Lord of Manor, I guess, that's kind of one of the tests of Sir Gawain's fortitude. It's got a couple of other kind of smaller stars, I think. I've seen the guy who played the Green Knight in a couple of different movies. Same with King Arthur. I forget the guy's name that played King Arthur, but he was in one of the latest Mission Impossible movies.
And Skeletor played his wife.
Skeletor.
She scared the shit out of me.
She was also a really scary queen in the Game of Thrones series.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think I remember you telling me that.
Yeah.
I've not seen Game of Thrones yet. That's one of the ones I haven't seen.
Don't see it.
I've not even read the books.
The first couple of seasons are pretty great, but then those later seasons are just, what are you doing?
Yeah.
It's pretty bad. But what isn't bad is Green Knight. Had a budget of $15 million and a box office of 18.1. So didn't lose its shirt in the deal, but certainly didn't make as huge a splash as I'm sure they wanted it to make. Which is really disappointing because it is a phenomenal movie.
Beautifully shot,
beautifully acted. I feel like the direction was really awesome. And what worked so well for the story, I think, for me, was the way in which it was all kind of thematically bound by this exploration of what use chivalry is to a world of human vice or human vices. It digs into, I think, the original mythology, which was all about kind of like the moral decay of the Arthurian court. Because that was kind of the whole point of the Green Knight, right?
Yeah.
What's the story of the Green Knight as you remember it?
So the Green Knight, Gawain is in King Arthur's court. I think you and I researched it, and I think we did read that he is King Arthur's nephew. That's who he is in the movie, too. And they're having a celebration in Christmas when the Green Knight strolls in and he says, any man, I forget how he lays the challenge down to them, but he's like, any man who can chop off my head, I want to see who's capable of doing this. And then they have to come and meet me next year at this time.
It's actually a little bit more nuanced than that.
Okay.
He basically says, anyone who would like to take up my challenge, lay upon me a blow. And after that is done, I will return a like blow to them 1 year hence. So the idea, of course, is kind of
this. No, this isn't an early LGBTQ movie, story. This is from like the Middle Ages. They're not talking about that kind of blow. They're talking about swords, which is still kind of phallic. So maybe, I don't know. But anyway, go ahead.
Lean into it. Why
sure,
not?
Why not?
Sure. Let's make it weird. No, so Sir Gawain kind of
anybody wants to give me a blow, I'll give him a similar blow later.
We definitely just lost Rudy Giuliani, by the way. That's going to be a recurring joke. I'm just throwing that out there.
I mean, I know he was in that Borat sequel when he really wanted a blow.
Blow for blow. Right. So
the theme running through this episode.
Alien.
It's all about blowjobs. All about blowjobs. We're going to turn every movie we talk about into a blowjob. Oh, no. Just wait till we get to Don't Breathe.
That's going to be so rude.
Go ahead. Keep going with the story.
I don't like it. All right. The Night House takes on a new meaning entirely. All right. So anyway, Sir Gawain says, I'll take up this challenge. That's fine. And he goes up and beheads the Green Knight. Right. And that's supposed to kind of be the finish. Right. Because like, who can come back from that unless you're a sorceress, weird, like fey creature or whatever. Right.
Well, this thing looks like a tree anyway.
It looks like a tree.
Groot's ancestor, I think.
Yeah. I think it's supposed to kind of look like that in the book, too.
See, we should have reread the book. We should have reread the book, and we should have watched that Sword in the Valiant with Sean Connery playing the Green Knight.
We may have
to come back to it. He was literally just painted green.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Wasn't Sean Connery also in another Arthur story?
We thought so, but I looked it up. It was whatever that Excalibur movie was around the same time, but he wasn't in that. I looked on IMDb.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the John Borman Excalibur movie.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. But he played King Arthur in the First Knight.
Robin Hood. Yeah. Oh, yeah, in First Knight. First Knight. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's true.
No, King Arthur was played by our friend Patrick Stewart in Men in Tights.
Yeah, Men in Tights. But what about the original Robin Hood the shitty one with Kevin Costner?
I don't even remember that. I mean, I know Alan Rickman was in there.
Yeah.
Making jokes about cutting your heart out with a spoon.
Yeah, and I feel like the reason for the jokes for Robin Hood, Men in Tights, like the appearance of Patrick Stewart at the end, was spoofing the appearance, and I think it was King Arthur at the end of that, playing King John.
It could be.
Wouldn't have been King Arthur. It'd have been King John.
It could be. Yeah.
I mean,
King John. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I am the only Robin Hood that speaks with an English accent. That's from Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
So the Green Knight gets beheaded. Well, man, it is so hard to tell a story when you don't have like the summary straight in front of you. I feel like we just go on tangents.
I mean,
all the time.
I typed up a whole script. I forgot the summary, but you're right.
It's all good. So he cuts off his head, and then the Green Knight picks up his head and says, "All right, cool. Thanks, bro. I'll see you in a year." And now Sir Gawain has to embark on a journey to go meet this Green Knight and receive the blow in kind, right? Which means he's going to get his head cut off.
Good clarification there. Good clarification.
Yeah, right. And the top head.
It's not
head,
a kind
not,
blow. It's
not the bottom head.
This isn't a happy head. Ending.
Oh, man, we're definitely going to have to add that explicit tag on this episode.
I think all of our episodes need explicit tags.
Yeah, so Dev Patel, as Sir Gawain, then embarks on this journey. He runs into a bunch of different people along the way where his mettle is tested and really his chivalric spirit is tested until finally he meets with the Green Knight and has to kind of face the culmination of his decisions in life. So what works about this movie?
So it has a beautiful sequence at the end that really kind of, actually it has a lot of beautiful sequences throughout the whole story. The scene with the young lady that recently starred in the Falcon and the Winter Soldier series as one of the villains.
Yeah, yeah.
Her scene in The Green Knight with Dev Patel, where she's this ghost who's been murdered, is beautifully shot. It's wonderfully rendered. Mm-hmm. One of the shots that sticks out to me that talks about how it does something really well, but it also speaks to one of the few weaknesses of the movie, is the ending scene. When the Green Knight's about, and this isn't a spoiler because I'm not going to talk about what actually happens. I mean,
can we actually spoil like a 14th century poem?
We've already spoiled a 73-year-old story.
Yeah.
So we might as well spoil this too. But the Green Knight's about to cut his head off, and Dev Patel's Gawain has this moment of cowardness, and he runs away, and he's like, no, give me a second. And then the Green Knight tries again. Are you ready? He goes, yeah. And he goes to swing again. He's like, no, give me another second. And he ends up running away. And it's this musically very limited sound or dialogue kind of scene, mm-hmm. where it's going through life with him. He sees Arthur die. He sees the woman he's in love with at the beginning of the film. She gives birth to a child, but now he's king, so he can't have a relationship with her. So he's forced to marry for convenience, but he takes the child as his own anyway. Mm-hmm. He grows up. The kingdom is starting to fall apart. And I think at this point, I leaned over to you or you leaned over to me, and we're like, this is a dream sequence.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it was, because it flashes back and he's back there and he's almost like watched his entire life flash before him. Like, if he runs away at this point, how his life is going to turn out. And at that point, he makes the decision not to run away. Now, I won't spoil what happens at the end. Partly because I'm not sure, but I know within the story, the 14th century story, he doesn't actually get his head cut off.
No,
the knight's
he just
it's all
gets
about
nicked.
The,
right, yeah, he gets cut.
The knight tests his metal and he sends him on his way back home.
Right, having taught him a very important lesson about the importance of chivalry. Right?
What I struggle with this movie is there's some exposition, and I hate movies with way too much exposition. Yeah. But this movie doesn't have quite a bit enough exposition to help fill in a few of those gaps.
It really throws you into the story and just says, go.
Yeah.
Like, I had to kind of piece together who some of the characters were even, like after the movie was over. And I only did that kind of by looking through a lot of what David Lowery said in interviews or wrote about the movie. Because apparently the movie had a completely different cut. And because of the pandemic, Lowery just decided to recut the movie entirely. And as a result, we end up with what I think is a much stronger film than what he kind of says the original cut would have been. Because the ambiguity of the ending, I think, really works in its favor pretty well.
I think the ambiguity, once we figured it out, kind of works. There's still some things in there where I wish there could have been a little bit more exposition.
Man, I don't know
what the giants
were doing in there.
What the fuck was that about?
I have no idea what the giants were. Everything else about
creepy,
the movie
weird,
works
pale
really,
blue giant things.
Yeah, it works really well thematically, I think, everything else in the movie. You know, every episode he comes into, there's like a purpose to that episode to show you the flaws in this guy's character and the ways in which he has to grow by the end of the movie. And that I think he does. I think he, as a character, matures immensely by the end of the movie, because he makes the decision, the final decision, that I think is the most impactful, which is to stay and see the consequences of his actions through to conclusion.
Right. I will say that even though I'm disappointed in the amount of exposition that could have been in there, just a little bit more to help explain things, I wasn't turned off by the movie because of that.
Right.
So I still think it's a really great movie. I think people should really, really go see it.
Yeah.
Just like, go ahead.
No, I agree. And I think that similarly, they should go see 9 Days, right?
Yeah, exactly. 9 Days. Beautiful film. Trevor, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
You have a kid.
Sure. No.
You're in a concentration camp.
Oh.
The guard sees the kid steal something and says, he said, I can either kill your kid or I can kill everybody else here. What do you do? I'm going to yell at you for no unnecessary reason right now and ask you, what do you do?
I mean,
this is actual dialogue from 9 Days.
This is from the movie. Yeah.
But
it's a really important thought experiment because,
what do you do?
Like, how do you make a decision? I mean, my decision, of course, is to do nothing. Because if he kills my kid or he kills everybody, that's on him. That's his sin. It's not my sin. I don't need to make a decision about what some maniac is going to do. Because, I mean, what's the end result? Like, I bear no guilt over what I can't control.
Ah, interesting. You get a big X.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I would never make it as a human being. Right?
So, yeah, neither would I. So all of this being said, this is all from 9 days. I bet you think we're going to pan it because we usually pair up a good story with a bad story. But in this case, I think we both really like this movie.
I saw it twice.
You saw it twice? Oh, yeah, you did because you went to see it.
I went to see it and then I said, dude, we cannot go. We can't let this go out of theaters without seeing it. And it's spectacular. Directed by Edson Oda, written by Edson Oda, starring Winston Duke, who is the guy from Black Panther, the big gorilla guy.
Yeah, yep.
Mm-hmm. Zazie Beetz, Benedict Wong, who people will know as
Wong from
Marvel's.
It's a real stretch on that
Doctor
character
Strange
name, wouldn't it?
Right, right, yeah. Benedict Wong. Tony Hale from like everything, but definitely yeah. Arrested Development.
Yeah.
And then Bill Skarsgård,
Pennywise
the clown.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting cast that they've put together,
and they work well together.
Oh
they have great chemistry. All of them
just deliver such great character work in the scenes that they've got.
So this is a really cool genre flick because Winston Duke is a character who was once alive, who is now charged with finding the right soul to be born and to go into a body. So these people come in, Zazie Beetz and Tony Hale and Bill Skarsgård and others, they come in and he basically tests them over the course of 9 days to see if they're worthy of getting a soul. And Benedict Wong plays a character that supervises him and he's his friend,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't, he's never been born. So this is a weird like afterlife, pre-life kind of crossroads. The setting is very, very bleak. Very
almost
bleak.
Minimalist.
Almost minimalist. Had a $10 million budget. Unfortunately, it only made $810,836 at the box office.
I feel like that's a real mistake of how this movie was marketed. Because yeah. I didn't even know that it existed until I just tripped across a preview in one of the movies that I went to see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to kind of put together the weird vibe that this movie gives because it's so strange and it very anachronistic in a lot of ways, but it works in this movie's favor because by kind of divorcing us a little bit from the immediate immersion into the film by causing us to question like what's going on. It's another movie that does not give us a whole ton of exposition. It gives us just enough so that we understand the stakes of what's going on. Or the
but I
premise.
Feel like, too, it gives us enough exposition in the right places.
In the right places.
That we know.
Right.
And that's where I feel like the Green Knight kind of faltered
right.
a little
bit. So whereas it disorients at the very beginning, I think, it fills in the gaps eventually so that, you know, hopefully you're really invested in the story and the characters that are developing. It's a beautiful contemplation, I think, on life and life's troubles, but also the kind of surreptitious beauty, the sublime beauty of life and experience. It has a final act, or really not even a final act, it's more like the final scene of the film where they dig up poetry from Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. It like the most beautifully delivered Walt Whitman I've ever heard. I was in tears.
I'm gonna pair it right up there with Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams.
Oh.
His delivery of some of the poetic lines and including Walt Whitman in there.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. I bet I tie them. I think Winston Duke did just as good a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's absolutely phenomenal.
But I think
adored it.
And what I love about this movie is that there's two conflicts, really, right? Mm-hmm. There's the exterior conflict of which soul is going to get it. And so really this comes down to Zazie Beetz and Bill Skarsgård's characters. And they're both very, very strong contenders for this life.
Right. But also very different.
Very, very different. Like, I don't want to get into necessarily how they're different, because I think that's the fun of the movie.
Yeah.
But I'm really interested in this other conflict, which is with Winston Duke, and it's internal.
Yeah.
Because he promoted this woman that he thought would be totally perfect for this life, and he learns over the course of the film that she's killed herself, that she's committed suicide. Right. And he's destroyed by this.
Yeah.
And this is affecting his decision now that he has to make with these new characters.
Right.
And I think both conflicts go so well together as the movie progresses. It really didn't feel like an over 2 hour long movie to me.
No, was it over 2 hours?
I think it's like 2+ hours. I think it's like, I feel like it was.
Like, wow. I did not feel that way at all. Yeah. It hooked me from the very beginning.
Yeah,
with the violin solo that they play. And I was in tears several times through my first viewing of the movie. When I went to see it a second time, the kind of middle sequence where it really tries to get some tears out of you didn't work on me quite as effectively, because I was then aware of what it was doing. But that final scene with Winston Duke and Walt Whitman, it just drives me to tears every time I think about it.
Yeah.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And one of the things that like I got into literature and kind of like cultural studies just on the strength of some of those feelings that I had over poetry and over literature. And to see this rendition of Walt Whitman, I think was just like, and this is why I do literature. You know, it's just so powerful. It was such a beautiful movie.
And to carry on our double entendres for single entendre, he does offer, he's one of the few, whatever these beings are called, that judges these souls or the veracity of these souls or whatever. Mm-hmm. He is one of the only that offers the rejected a chance at a happy ending.
Yeah.
He does. He gives them a happy ending. He's like, think about a moment that you've witnessed that you want to experience, and I'll recreate that for you as best I can.
Yeah.
So
it's a really wonderful movie.
It was a wonderful, wonderful movie.
Yeah.
So then Trevor and I both decided we needed to go see Don't Breathe 2.
Man.
Well, we decided we had to go see Don't Breathe 2. You all wouldn't have to.
You go from the highest of the highs to like the lowest of the lows.
But before, because neither one of us had seen Don't Breathe, the original. So we rented that on Amazon Prime. And I think we spent way too much money on that.
Worst $4 I have ever spent.
So maybe we should talk about Don't Breathe and Don't Breathe 2.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a No Doubt song? Oh, wait, that was Don't Speak.
I really am.
They really shouldn't have spoken there. If you guys think my accents or my dialect is a little weird today because of my allergy issues, let me tell you, Stephen Lang puts on his worst.
What is Stephen Lang doing?
I think he wants to be Bane from Dark Knight Rises.
It's so weird.
But he's like talking like this, and his accent changes every time.
Jeremy!
Like, it's Trevor.
I've forgotten my laundry.
How do you see to turn the dials?
How do I seem to turn the dial?
No, he does.
Oh, he does?
He's blind. Is he like listen for the clicks?
You know, I don't understand anything about this movie. He's got a VCR and he's just playing the VHS over and over and over. He's got a woman trapped in his basement with like this weird.
This is the first one, folks.
This is the first one in Don't Breathe.
Most of you might have seen it because it had a $9.9 million budget and $157.8 million gross.
$8 million?
$4 of which is yours.
I'm sorry to the world for those $4.
I spent $4 on this movie.
The only other movie that had worse accents than this was Reminiscence.
Man, the accent, Lisa Joy as accent coach, someone should fire her. I don't, she wasn't the actual accent coach, but she should have known better.
Yeah.
I don't even know what the accents were in that movie. I don't know. It was the weirdest, like, Chicago gangster in Miami. It was
This bizarre. Is Reminiscence, folks, not Don't Breathe and not Don't Breathe.
Don't Breathe just sounds like this. Stephen Lang.
Like, he's not breathing. He's Bane that can't breathe.
I'm upset that they didn't name Don't Breathe 2 Continue Not Breathing.
Yeah. Start CPR.
Please breathe. Yeah, start CPR. Please
don't breathe.
You should have taken a breath by now.
Start resuscitation.
Gosh, what a terrible movie. No, he's got... So I'm really confused about this blind man, right? Because he's like... He has a VHS tape of his daughter or whatever that he just plays on repeat. He's got a VCR and it's playing constantly. He has a woman in the basement that he's like tied up with this weird BDSM leather suspension cable.
It's like when Daredevil got older, he just got dementia and went crazy.
No, he's doing like this. It's weird. I guess this is like, what if Daredevil were a rapist? That's the movie.
And serial killer.
Fede Alvarez, the director and writer of this
movie. He's responsible for both of them.
He was just like, you know, what if Daredevil was a rapist? And now we have this terrible movie where Stephen Lang is doing an accent I truly don't understand.
Yeah.
But I'm also just like, how did he construct this weird harness thing? Like, did he have someone come in and install it? And the guy who installed it was just like, I know what you're doing, buddy.
Yeah, I bet you don't.
You probably killed him afterward.
I probably did. I don't know. And that's another thing. He's got like this weird survival chamber in his basement too, with like a bunch of supplies. And I'm like, I'm not trying to be like anti-blind people, but I'm like, how does he do any of this alone, like completely unassisted?
It's no spoiler now, but how did he even impregnate the woman?
Did
he just ask her to play Marco Polo?
I don't know. He
the turkey baster. Marco Polo, you know.
That was another thing. He was like,
I'm not a rapist.
But then like, but bro, like, do you just not know the definition of rape? Because there are different kinds of rape for sure. Golly, it was just it was so terrible. It was such a bad movie.
Well, Don't Breathe 2 only cost $15 million, so they didn't increase the budget that much, but it only made $42.2
million. Yeah,
so.
If I was confused about the plot of Don't Breathe 1, I was even more confused about Don't Breathe 2. Because in Don't Breathe 1, they're like, here's Stephen Lang. He's this blind monster, which is already kind of, I'm kind of like, that's kind of mean. Like,
Stephen Lang, by the way, folks, is credited as being a 20-year horror veteran. He's famous for Avatar, and that's about it.
Yeah, and Don't Breathe.
And he had some like bit parts in some other movies. But one article we read about him said he was a 20-year horror veteran.
A 20-year horror veteran.
I know Avatar doesn't stand
in like
up
five movies.
And like it did when it first came out, but do we really call it a horror film? Like,
no, it's not. It's
horrible.
It's definitely not.
But it's not.
But I'm confused because it like this blind guy.
Let's use our genitals to connect to horses so we can fly around with them.
That's.
And James Cameron's coming out with six more of those too. So, you know, as long as it's taken him to make them, that's just going to be shit.
Stephen Lang's just raping Jane Levy in the meantime. Like that. This is side gig.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So I'm so confused about the blind guy and like, how does he manage any of his affairs in this movie? But then Don't Breathe 2, after firmly establishing like this guy's terrible, right? Like he's a murderer. He's a rapist. They turn him into the hero of the second movie. And here's, I'm scratching my head because I'm like, how do you take a character that evil and make him into a hero? What would you do as a writer, Jeremy, if you were like, I have gone off the deep end to make this guy a total monster. How do I redeem him? What do you do?
So there is a level of hierarchy of virtue to villainous.
Right.
It consists of about 9 levels. And the school of thought is that when you're taking a character from really virtuous to really villainous, you don't have to hit every level. You can just kind of skip down. But if you're going to take that character and make them very villainous to start and then try and make them a hero, then you have to gradually work your way up. We have to see them change.
So in the gradation of like villainous and trying to get back up to virtuous, like, what's the worst thing that you could do as a villain? I'm just...
So it's 9 stages, and there's 3 virtue, and I'm going off of memory on this, folks, so please, I don't have it in front of me. I didn't think to print this off and bring it, and I should have. But there's 3 virtuous, there's 3 kind of gray, kind of morally gray sections, and then there's three stages of pure villainy, with the third, with the ninth stage, the third and final stage, being completely villainous. Like, there's no redemption whatsoever. And so it's very hard to take a character from that stage and move them up at all.
Sure.
Usually the character has to be like 8 or 7. 7 is a villainous character who is really almost morally gray. They're a character who's making some questionable choices, and they're okay with those questionable choices, but they're still doing it for a little bit better reason than just being totally out and out evil. With 9, there's no redemption, and 8 is somewhere kind of in between that. So I would probably set him at an 8. But because they decided to make him a serial rapist and a serial killer in the first film.
And let's not forget his greatest sin, which is that accent.
Yeah, his acting. That puts him to me at a 9. Like at a 9 going, an 8 going into a 9. And that's very hard to redeem.
Yeah. So, of course, I think that the writers of this sequel, which is Fede Alvarez and Rodos Sayagues.
Yes.
Yeah. They decide that, like, well, the only real threshold that we haven't crossed here with this guy is animal cruelty. And as a result, I'm sorry, I just got freaked out by the lamp which fell over here.
That happened last time too, I think.
Yeah. Animal cruelty is like the one thing he doesn't do. And so in this movie, they're like, well, we got to redeem him. How do we do it? Let's make him save a dog. And the guy that he's fighting would kill the dog. And now you're like, oh man, I'm totally on Stephen Lang's side. The plot is also bizarre in Don't
Sounds
Breathe
like
2.
They just watch too much like John Wick.
Oh, it's awful. And yeah, the action sequences make, again, he's just Daredevil with
So like, who is the bad guy in this film? Because I didn't go see it.
The bad guy in this film is this weird drug dealer. It's set in Detroit, right?
Yeah.
And I want to wrap your head around this plot because it's insane.
You're telling me they made 2 movies of moral decay and crime set in Detroit? That's hard to believe.
Go figure. So this drug dealer wants to get his child back because at the very beginning of the movie, Stephen Lang kidnaps a child from a meth house fire. And the dad goes to prison for that fire because, of course, he's a meth dealer and had a meth lab in his basement. So he goes to prison. He comes back out of prison. Finds out that his wife or partner or whatever is dying from the meth house fire, from ingesting or like inhaling too many of the chemicals in that meth house fire. So hear me out.
How long was his prison sentence?
I don't. Like, it was like 8 years or something.
And it took her 8 years to die?
It took her 8 years to die of meth. So he's like, all right, my wife is dying. And I gotta help that because she's my meth cook. And if I don't have a meth cook, I don't have a meth business. And my meth business is really all I am.
Because there's a shortage of meth cooks out there.
Because there's a shortage of meth cooks in Detroit. So he's like, all right, well, in order to get
you could just come down to Arkansas and get a couple of meth cooks.
Or Detroit, right? So he's like, all right, I gotta save my wife. And he figures out that the only way to do that is to find like a genetic match for her organs. And he knows that they had a kid. He believed that the kid was dead though, because she's supposed to have died in this fire. So he's just trolling around Detroit, like in hopes of kidnapping a young girl who happens to be his daughter. And then in order to take her organs and put her organs into her or his wife, right? He has to have someone who can do that. So he hires like a serial murderer, like a serial killer in Detroit who's been cutting out people's organs. And he's like, hey, you want to do that? I'll pay you money to take my daughter's organs out and put
what
it in the wife.
What the fuck page of LinkedIn is he on anyway?
What baffles me is like his crazy elaborate plan to save his wife is somehow or another more convenient than just finding another meth cook in Detroit. I truly don't understand it. I'm confused by every element of this.
Speaking of LinkedIn, I'm getting on LinkedIn right now and here. Meth cooks. There's like 50 names popping up just in our area. Yeah, so,
I know. Yeah. I know half of them. I went to school with half of them.
Yeah, yeah. I think most of us did living in this part of, of the United States. Yeah,
sure. This is a weird aside about meth, but I went for Government Day my senior year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And for Government Day, they took us to the county courthouse. And they were like, hey, check out all of the things that we do in the government. And if you're really interested, you could become one of these clerks, too. And I was like, this is weird. All right. Local Government Day. And one of the stops on the tour of the county courthouse was also to go to the county jail. And so they bring us to the county jail, which is at capacity. And they're having us like stare at the inmates from their cell doors. They're like, come look at this inmate. Come look at this guy. You got to see this guy. And we're like, what the hell is going on? And I turned to the sheriff and I said, why are all of these people here? What did they do? And she looks at me and she goes, meth. And that was it. It was like, that's how I found out my county had like a huge meth problem.
That sounds like a worse experience than I had my senior year. I was part of a health, like a pre-med kind of health kind of class where they taught you some basic like first aid and introduced you to the health communities and all this. And so for our big field trip, they took us down to Houston's medical district, and they took us to the cardiac surgery place. And we got to stand in the skylight area of the theater and look down and watch them as they were giving open heart surgery to a patient. And then after that, they took us to lunch at Pizza Hut, which didn't really...
Open heart surgery, Pizza Hut.
Yeah. Like, this is what happens to you if you don't eat right. Now let's go eat at Pizza Hut. Hey, guess what? I'm getting really into this songwriting stuff. So want to hear a song I made up?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, ready? All right. Now, again, my singing voice isn't all there, so we'll just... But here it goes. Candyman. Candyman, he can do things only candy can. Candyman, Candyman, he'll melt in your mouth and not in your hands. Look out, it's the Candyman. And if you sing that into a mirror one time, you said his name five times, so now he'll appear to you.
I'm dying over here. I'm dying because of that melt in your mouth and all the blowjob references.
It was between that and what are you doing with that hook? No. Heard of a rusty nail, but this is ridiculous.
Candyman. Oh boy.
It was between that and that older song, you know, who can take his hook hand and stab you in the guts? Who can take a bunch of bees and sting you in the nuts? The Candyman can. Some kind of, I don't know. I'm torn between the two songs. I don't know which one I like better.
Who can take his own hand? Oh man, that's one.
So guess what we're talking about next, folks?
Candyman.
We're talking about Candyman.
Oh boy.
There are no reflective services in the studios. So.
Oh thank God, we can say
we can say his name as shit many as times as we want.
Yeah.
Directed by Nia DaCosta.
Mm-hmm.
Written by Jordan Peele, DaCosta, and Wynn Rosenfeld. Starring. Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, Tiona Paris.
The two. Nathan Stewart Jarrett, Coleman Domingo, Virginia Madsen, and Tony Todd.
And Virginia Madsen's voice, because we all know what happened to Virginia Madsen in the first film. This is a direct sequel to that first movie, skipping over the two sequels that came afterward in the 90s.
Yeah.
$25 million budget, $55.8 million box office. I loved, absolutely loved.
Me too, man.
This movie. They had a really good understanding of the themes that they wanted to discuss.
Yeah.
And they executed them perfectly. They blended CGI special effects really well with practical effects.
Yeah, the practical effects are spectacular.
I love that you only catch Candyman in the reflection of the mirrors.
Yes, it was so fun to see that.
Like when the one victim gets it and you just get a cutaway shot of like her apartment and her like high rise,
mm-hmm.
And you just see like her body lifting up and getting smashed against the window and like
it's crazy.
You don't see the Candyman though.
Yeah,
which
yeah, the same in the art gallery. I think you had stepped out for that scene, but in the art gallery, yeah. this guy gets it like gruesomely, and you only catch Candyman in the reflections around the room. You know, otherwise he's just being like slaughtered.
And they don't rely on jump scares.
No, it had very, very few jump, if any, jump scares. Really.
I think that one scene where she finds the paintings that he's been painting, that Anthony's been painting,
yeah.
And he comes in behind her and yells at her. I think that's the one kind of really jump scare. But yeah. The rest of it's just creep factor. And I love that in the movie.
It was really, really great. A lot of critics have been talking about how preachy it was, how didactic so much of the story was in a way. But I kind of want to push back against some of that idea that for some reason or another, art can't be didactic. I think there are times in which that can become really annoying, or it can become really, I don't know, uninteresting. But I felt in this movie especially, the kind of didactic tone or the preachy tone kind of worked. I don't know. It worked for me. I felt like I was really into it. And I felt like it clarified some of what it was trying to do thematically speaking, so that we're of the same kind of accord as we encounter this new interpretation of the legend of Candyman.
Yeah, if they dialed it back at all, I wouldn't have dialed the exposition back very much. But this idea that horror transcends generations and can keep coming back, and that each of the potential victims of Candyman see the Candyman that they are most familiar with in legend.
Right, right.
With it all starting with Tony Todd, but then there were others as they come along. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's a really interesting take on this idea of like historic trauma, black trauma. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting. I think it's also really interesting that the characters that encounter Candyman interpret Candyman differently according to their lived experiences.
Right, right, right.
So you look at like a lot of the white characters that encounter Candyman and get slaughtered by him, right, are kind of traditionally in these more aggressor type roles.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think that
like the bathroom full of high school girl bullies.
Right, exactly. Whereas I think the marginalized characters in the story see Candyman as more of a tragic figure and sometimes even like a savior kind of figure.
I mean,
like a symbolic writer of wrongs. Stephen Graham Jones he said something interesting when he wrote The Only Good Indians, where he was talking about mm-hmm. the slasher. And what's really interesting about the slasher is that it can reinforce this idea of a kind of perverse justice. Right. In which the slasher comes out and annihilates everybody bad. And the only ones who remain are those who are somehow or another like ideologically pure or you know, morally pure or something of that sort.
And in the 80s, this was always like the virgin and or like the nerd or something.
It takes on like a very literal metaphor. Yeah.
And thankfully, Scream and all of its meta commentary deconstructed that whole idea for us. But now, in Candyman, we do have those virtuous characters surviving and not being affected. And given what happens at the end, and again, I don't want to spoil it, but Tioni Paris's character is virtuous.
Yeah.
She's a final girl. She's a final girl. But I can say, imagining what happens after the credits roll in this story, her life is fucked.
Oh, yeah.
Like, absolutely. She might be a final girl, but her life is fucked.
It's really, really interesting. I feel like it is an interesting conversation starter. I had a really great time with Candyman.
I did, too.
On the other hand, I did not enjoy The Night House.
Yeah.
David Bruckner directed that one, written by Ben Collins and Luke Piotrowski.
Good job.
Stars stars Rebecca Hall, Sarah Goldberg, Evan Jonikite, Stacey Martin, Vondi Curtis Hall. Rebecca Hall, she's fine. She does a good job. I felt like it was a fine performance from her.
And I enjoy Vondi Curtis Hall and things I've seen him in before, and he did okay in this.
Yeah. The performances were not bad at all. And even some of the conceptual horror that they give us, the architectural horror, I think is interesting because the boogeyman in this story of Night House, in which basically a woman feels as though she's being haunted by her dead husband. It conceptually, it's really interesting because the boogeyman only exists in the negative spaces of the house.
Yeah, I love that effect.
It's such an interesting idea. And I think that as a study of grief, it could work really, really well. Because when you think of a haunting, as we oftentimes talk about, when you think of a haunting is really kind of the revisitation of some kind of either memory or some kind of, you know, vengeful spirit or whatever, but it's a revisitation of these human elements left behind. And so in an architecture, in a house or something like that, where you lose a loved one and that loved one used to occupy the same lived space that you were in, the negative space is becoming something menacing or threatening to your happiness, I think is really interesting. I think that makes for an interesting ghost.
Yeah, I agree.
Unfortunately, that is not what this movie does. It's not a movie that is about the haunting of being left behind.
It should be, but it isn't. Whereas Candyman has a really great understanding of theme and how to use it and incorporate that into the story, I don't think the Night House knows what theme is. As college educators, if somebody were to turn in a paper and of this, we would, our first question, I think, would be, what is your thesis statement?
What are you doing? It feels muddled.
What are you trying to do? What do you want to say? They don't know what they want to say in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. As a result, it just feels super weird and schizophrenic. The boogeyman is depression, I guess. But is it? I don't know. It's also super confusing because we find out that the husband has been living a double life, which again could be very interesting in complicating our feelings about the memory of someone. You know, just recently this week, there was some revelation about Bob Ross's life, and like Bob Ross cheated on his wife, and people are now finding this out on social media, and they're like, oh, how dare you, Bob Ross? And so there's this kind of like feeling of a violation of the adoration they had for someone. So here we have Rebecca Hall's husband, and
I wonder if Bob Ross used any of his famous lines from his show, like when he was with his mistress.
I don't know.
Like, we're going to have a happy little tree live here. I'm going to just take this brush and beat the devil out of it. Just beat it up.
Oh, no. Bob Ross, slow down. No, but
good night and God bless.
Good night and God bless. Oh, no. No, so she finds out that her husband has like been spending his free time building a mirror house out in the woods across the lake from them, and then murdering women and storing them in the floorboards of this new, not a house. And I'm just so confused. I'm like, what is this supposed to be or mean?
Well,
or
and he was doing it to save her from the boogeyman from depression. Like that was coming after her and wanted to kill her this entire time.
It's so bizarre. I truly don't understand what he's trying to do with this story. It doesn't work. It's trying to do too many things, and none of those things really contribute very clearly to the theme that he's trying to explore.
Or themes they're trying to explore. You can have multiple themes in, in a story. Yeah. You know, another one that didn't do really well for me, and I'm a huge fan of the Marvel Universe. I grew up as a kid. Let me give you some backstory. I grew up as a kid reading mainly Marvel comics and some DC. Mm-hmm. But with DC, I had, you know, we had the old movie of Christopher Reeve's Superman, and then that series. Yeah. We had Tim Burton's Batman. So we had some great live action DC heroes already. Marvel, we didn't. Marvel, we had a shitty ass Captain America. We had a Fantastic Four that was buried and, you know, that they didn't even want to release.
I've seen that movie.
I've heard it's awful.
It's bad.
The Captain America was bad enough, but like that 90s Captain America.
Mr. Fantastic in that Fantastic Four movie has pool noodles for arms.
Cool. No, I want to see it.
It's wild, man.
So I get into the 2000s and we get Sam Raimi's Spider-Man. We get Blade.
Excellent. Yeah.
We get the X-Men, which was, again, not a great movie. Like, Bryan Singer really screwed up that franchise, but he he at least took it seriously in that first movie, and it was decent. It was okay. The second one was really good. I don't think they gave enough credit and enough time for like Cyclops as the leader. They focused too much on Wolverine, who didn't even look like Wolverine in the comics. But the point is, we were getting some good movies, and I could finally start to envision some solid superhero movies from Marvel. And then Marvel in 2008, they're not acquired by Disney yet. They are basically bankrupt. They take their last bit of money and they give it to the director you would least think would be connected to a Marvel movie, and Jon Favreau. And they hire a strung out, drug addicted, straight out of rehab, Robert Downey Jr. And they're like, we're giving you a one-time character that was an alpha character, but now he's relegated to like the B-list. We're giving you Iron Man. And they fucking knocked it out of the park.
It was insane.
That saved them. And so we see Marvel and the MCU as this huge juggernaut now, but they didn't start out like that. They were on their last leg. So I'm really impressed with where they've come. And I have wanted for 10 years a good Black Widow movie.
Oh, hands down.
And she deserved to be the first female superhero really highlighted. Like, she should have had a movie before Wonder Woman in DC. Like, the DCEU's got its own crap going on.
I mean,
like,
I kind of disagree, but because Black Widow has never been a super important character in the Marvel mythos. It's only been recently that she's kind of been brought up as a quintessential Avenger.
Well, true, in the comic books, but I'm just thinking from the establishment within the movies, I feel like she should have had an early...
I mean, I'm super pissed. Oh, man, I will go off on Wonder Woman because I hated those movies. I thought they missed the entire point of those characters.
Oh, they absolutely did.
But I agree. I think Black Widow could have been the kind of trendsetter with regards to female-led superhero movies.
Yeah.
It should have been. She should have had a movie way before now. Way before, certainly, they killed her character off.
Yeah.
In the most recent, Infinity Saga. So they bring us this character, this movie.
Spoiler alert, folks, she didn't get that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So she gets this movie now that is very difficult to, like, what are you going to do? How are you going to give this character any real character growth after you've completed this character's arc? And I don't even think that arc was all that good, to be honest. I really, really struggled with how they treated Black Widow through this whole experience.
Yep.
And then we get a movie this summer, her solo outing, and there were two highlights for me of the movie. David Harbour.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It was so much fun to watch. And Florence Pugh.
Yeah.
Who plays Yelena Belova, the new Black Widow. She was a delight.
And three for me because I was always a fan of the Mummy movie. Rachel Weisz. Rachel Weisz.
I just don't know what she was doing in this movie.
I don't know what she was doing in the movie, but I always like to see Rachel Weisz.
Oh, sure. I mean, we can watch her for days.
Yeah, yeah. So directed by Kate Shortland, written by Eric Pearson, with story by Jack Schaefer and Ned Benson. Also in it, O.T. Fabinley, Olga Kurylenko, William Hurt, and Ray Winstone. Budgeted $200 million, grossed only $372 million, and I know that was contentious because I don't know if that counts like the Disney Plus money. And I think Scarlett Johansson, at last I heard, she's suing them over that because she didn't make as much because I guess her pay got cut being on Disney Plus.
Right. It's such a disappointing movie on the whole. This is the first Marvel movie that I really felt like I was so let down. The third act was so boring.
Yeah.
I've seen that movie. Like, I've seen that third act. It was Captain America and the Winter Soldier. It worked for me then, but it doesn't work now. It just doesn't feel earned. The villain, what was he doing? Like, I can't, even today, explain to you what the whole purpose of the movie was. Or what the stakes were. It was just so blah. It was like, here's generic bad guy number one. They took one of my favorite, like, villains, Taskmaster, and just did nothing with it. I mean, Taskmaster shows up for like two scenes and they're not even, I mean, one of them's kind of interesting, but then the others.
And I felt like they ripped off another villain when they did Taskmaster. Like, isn't it basically just the Winter Soldier over again?
I mean, kind of. Yeah. The brainwashing thing became the whole motif. It was like they tried to have Captain America, the Winter Soldier part two, but it just doesn't work.
So one of the things that didn't work for me craft-wise was just this uneven editing. It reminded me of, and I don't want people to think I'm going to be slamming Marvel TV shows, because on the whole, I've enjoyed the Marvel TV shows. I've enjoyed WandaVision. It had problems, but I still enjoyed it.
I had some problems with WandaVision.
I enjoyed it. Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I loved Loki. Loki's my favorite so far.
Absolutely.
Falcon and the Winter Soldier had the same kind of editing problems. And as much as I want to love those characters and that story, it just had too many holes. And they had the same kind of editing problems here in Black Widow, where it was just too choppy, too cut up. I didn't enjoy the, like, I don't know if Courtney Love would just not sell the rights to Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, but this hackneyed pop culture female singing like a real slow version of Smells Like Teen Spirit just sucked ass.
That was the weirdest.
Took the teeth out of the fucking song.
The weirdest song choice I've seen in a movie. And I mean, Marvel movies have a very liberal use of licensed soundtracks.
They could have given Courtney Love some money to purchase the rights to play that movie.
I just don't understand what they were doing with that rendition. It didn't work thematically at all. It took me out of the movie.
You know what would have been a better song if they were going to use a Nirvana song? They've been using it on that new Batman trailer. Nirvana's Something in the Way as the opening to that that Black Widow movie would have been pitch, and it's slow and it's haunting, and that would have been a terrific song.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen Shang-Chi yet, but in comparison to Black Widow, I already feel like this is a much better movie.
It's so much better. And I mean, it's not without its faults. There are certainly some pieces, I think, of Shang-Chi where they're trying very deliberately to tie Shang-Chi into the greater Marvel universe. And some of that has to be done because, you know, like they're trying to set up stories. So I'm giving them a lot of patience in being like, I want to see what story you're coming up with next. So tie this into your larger universe. I'm cool with that. It just felt like those moments, the bits where they're very deliberately trying to tie Shang-Chi into everything else, felt out of place, and it felt like it slowed down the momentum of the movie for me. But otherwise, outside of those elements, this was hands down my favorite like blockbuster experience of the summer.
Cool. I can't wait to see this.
It was so much fun.
I will admit, I'm not a huge fan of Awkwafina and that persona she takes on.
I loved her, though.
Like,
I think she's so fun. She's so much fun. There's just, I don't know. There's so much in here. Tony Leung, I don't know how to say his last name.
Mm-hmm. Is he the Mandarin?
He's the Mandarin.
I've seen him in stuff before.
Crushes it. Like, crushes it. His performance of that character gives so much depth to what is ultimately just kind of a one-off villain, right? But he portrays him with just such human depth.
But how many Marvel movies have we seen where we've had that one-off villain and they're just two-dimensional or even just one-dimensional?
I mean, very often. Yeah. I'm still upset about Malekith. Like, yeah. I'm still upset about that. And I think
Thor the Dark World. I forgot about that movie.
Everyone should forget about that movie. It's like the worst of the Marvel movies for sure. Yeah, we have a lot of villains that I think these one-off villains are very underwhelming because you can't really give them a whole lot of a character arc. You can't really give them a whole lot of depth. I think that is not the case in Shang-Chi.
Cool.
I think that he has an immense amount of depth. And it plays into a lot of the story's themes. Again, this Shang-Chi is a lot about family drama and conflict and generational inheritance. It's about, you know, kind of these first generation immigrants, you know, living with their kids who don't really quite know how to make sense of their cultural identity. And the conflicts that arise from that, wanting to be one thing, but also being another thing, and having to take those two separate identities and kind of marry them together. It's a really interesting movie from a character perspective. So, yeah, great. I loved it.
So, don't spoil it for me, but does he have a happy ending?
I'm not going to spoil it for
you. Black Widow didn't have a happy ending. And Scarlett Johansson, if anybody deserves a happy ending.
I resent this bit the most about the movie with an Asian cast.
Oh, well, yeah, I wasn't even trying to go there, honestly. That was not my intention at all. Although there was, like, within the past 5 years, there was, like, a massage parlor here in Northwest Arkansas that was, unfortunately, Asian that was shut down because of happy endings.
Oh, no.
I really did not mean to go there. I'm sorry. That's not my I was just going for the general blowjob reference here, folks. That's it. That's it.
Nobody will ever listen to us again.
Well, now that I've successfully alienated people, I do want to talk a little bit about some things we've seen individually that kind of stood out to us.
Listen, my movie of the summer.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Space Jam 2.
Ugh.
Space Jam 2 is...
stood out in a good way or a bad way?
A cinematic masterpiece in terrible cinema. I'm telling you, it's up there. It's... if you can just, like, get slobbering drunk and watch this movie, I think that's the best way. It's soulless. It's just so immensely corporate. It's so bad. And the original Space Jam was no masterclass in filmmaking either. I mean, for those of you kids out there who are like, ah, yeah, Space Jam was the best, go watch that movie.
I think it's on Hulu.
It's, yeah, probably. It's somewhere. HBO Max, maybe?
Could be on HBO
go
Max.
Go watch the 1996 Space Jam and reflect on how absolutely shitty your taste in movies was when you were a child. It's unbelievable. But Space Jam 2, man.
So was there a movie or TV show that jumped out at you that you really liked?
I mean, we've kind of talked about them.
Okay, the ones
that I really, really liked.
So I've been doing date night with my wife, and date night, the PG version of what I'll tell you about date night, includes us watching TV shows on Saturday night. So we've binged a few shows. And right now, I'm mentioning this one first because I feel like maybe not a lot of people are aware of it. Go watch this show. It is hilarious. It's called Only Murders in the Building, and it's on Hulu. And it stars Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez. And they live in this really rich building. Steve Martin is an ex-actor. Martin Short is a failed director of, like, theater whose wife has left him.
I mean, you've already got my attention with Steve Martin and Martin Short.
And Selena Gomez is this weird, like, we don't really know who she is yet a few episodes in, except that she's there renovating her aunt's apartment. And all three of them are hooked on this true crime podcast that's hosted by Tina Fey. And there's a murder in their building. And they decide to revive their careers, and because they're all bonded by this podcast, to make their own podcast. And so they're trying to go around their building, find out who the murderer is. They've talked to Nathan Lane. They've talked to Sting, the musician, who Martin Short believes poisons his dog at one point. Because Sting's like, I hate dogs. Get him off me. Get him off my leg. And Martin Short's like, do you have a dog? And he's like, I have a dog. Yes, I hate him too. So this show is really great. It's only about 30 minutes long, the episodes. Yep. They are so fun. They do great character work for each of them. It's a great mystery. It's, again, something I could see Slay House publishing in book form or story form. I also really, really like, I want to mention this next show really quickly, Evil, which started out as a CBS drama. So it's on CBS. You're going to think, oh, well, that's crap, right? It's, like, terrible. But they moved it to Paramount Plus, and it stars Katja Herbers, who is a psychologist, Mike Coulter from the Netflix Marvel shows. He played the guy with the tough skin or whatever. I don't remember the character's name. And Asif Mandeev. And they work for the Catholic Church, and they're trying to provide proof of, like, supernatural events. So it kind of it straddles this line, right? But they've been, because they moved to Paramount Plus, they've opened themselves up as far as what they can and can't do. It's funny. It's wonderful when they're in this monastery where everyone's mandated to be quiet in one scene in one episode in season two. And Mike Coulter's character, the priest, goes in to pray with these monks who are all having to be quiet. And so he's trying, and they have to do everything by, like, you know, words on the screen because he can't talk. And so he's like, okay, you're just going to open your mind up. And this is set across the screen. Okay. You're just going to, you're going to talk to God. Fuck. Kristen Naked. And that's the Katya Herber's character. He's got a kind of a, he's crushing on her a little bit. And she's kind of crushing on him. And then he's like, he like envisions like their bodies entwined, like, you know, just segments of it. And then he's like, fuck, 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 just all across. And I'm just like busting up laughing. I think that's hilarious. I do. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say there is a movie that I actually, I forgot that I had seen it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually really good. Just Stillwater.
Okay.
Directed by Tom McCarthy. It's got Matt Damon, Camille Cotton, Abigail Breslin. It's about a guy. He's an Oklahoma oil rigger who goes to France to try to exonerate his daughter, who was put in a French jail after she allegedly murdered her roommate.
Cool.
It is a drama. It's very powerfully acted. Camille Cotton is wonderful. Matt Damon crushes it. I mean, it, like, watch Matt Damon in this movie as an Oklahoma oil rigger and you realize you know that person. Like, you interact with those people all the time.
I've passed him in the gas station at Casey's.
Yeah, exactly.
Breakfast sandwich from their pizza place.
Why are you getting a breakfast sandwich from Casey's?
Because it's quicker than going through McDonald's.
Oh, man. I'm so sorry.
That might be why my voice sounds like this. It might be too many breakfast sandwiches from Casey's. They might have, like, scarred my throat.
I'm so sorry.
Also want to quickly mention The Outsider and Lovecraft Country on HBO Plus or HBO Max.
I can vouch for Lovecraft Country.
They were really, Jonathan Majors, Journey Smollett, Courtney B. Vance, Michael Kenneth Majors from Lovecraft Country. Michael Kenneth Majors just passed away. Beautifully, beautiful. Much better than the book, I thought. Much better than the book. Yeah. They took the idea, the skeleton of the book, and really fleshed it out. The Outsider, based on a Stephen King novel, really, really good. Again, both of those are really good. They're great genre pieces, and they're really engaging.
Lots of fun stuff. Hey, what's going on with Slay House this month?
So we are open for submissions for our short story anthology, Tales of Slay House 2021. We are accepting stories in the science fiction, fantasy, horror, mystery, thriller kind of vein. So if you've got something that fits that, go ahead and submit to us. You can find our submission guidelines on our website, slayhouse.com/submissions page. Or you know what? Just go to slayhouse.com and check out all of our website. We have a current title out, A Mindful of Scorpions by J.R. Billingsley.
Speaking of media and media consumption, if you're into a reading experience that is like watching a television show, I really recommend A Mindful of Scorpions. It's a lot of fun to read.
We've got one professional book reviewer who has already released her review on Goodreads. This is a 300-plus page novel. She read it in a day.
Yeah.
She was hooked on it. She just wanted to binge it.
I know when I read it, I binge read it as well.
Yep. We are also, follow us on Twitter at House Slay. We are on Reddit at Slay House. We are on Instagram at Slay House and on TikTok at Slay House. We also have a Buy Me a Coffee and a Patreon. So don't forget to support us if you can. We're sharing proceeds from the Patreon with our studio, Wayne Howard Studio. They are very gracious to let us use the studio to shoot the podcast. These guys are wonderful, very professional, and we're having a wonderful experience with them. And I think in another week or two, we might have another couple episodes coming out. I think, I know we told people at one point we were going to do a real Hellraiser of an episode. I guess we lied to them. That is coming, but maybe not just yet. We need a little more time with that one.
Guys, I need to read books. I'm sorry.
My reading has been terrible.
I work so much.
Me too. So I think maybe coming up, we're going to have short stories by Edith Wharton and Horacio Quiroga. That's how you really pronounce it, folks, if you're not a stupid white redneck like me. Horacio Quiroga.
Horacio Quiroga? Is that some kind of superfood?
It is. It's like... It's right up there with quinoa.
Quinoa.
And
quesadilla.
Cali. and the other good stuff you're supposed to eat. All right. So that is Slayhouse Publishing. That's our movie review for the summer. Check some of these out. We'd love to hear what you guys think. So follow us on social media and give us your feedback. And we'll be back soon with a couple of new episodes.
See you on the dark side.